Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the picture, what I've left behind. You once again I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know what you've done.
Well, good evening and welcome to the Stop Child Abuse Now Talk radio show sponsored by NASCA, which stands for the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. My name is Penelope Bennis. I am from Bellevue, Washington, and I'm here with my co-host, Pamela Elaine Lockridge from Louisiana. We welcome everyone here this evening. And tonight is special guest night, and we have a very special guest this evening. His name is Simon David. He's from Chicago, Illinois. And before I tell you a little bit more about Simon, I wanted to talk to you about how to call in to the show to become a member of the panel. And have an opportunity to ask Simon, our special guest, a question or offer a comment surrounding his story. And the number to do so is area code 646-595-2118. So all you have to do is dial the number 646-595-2118. Pamela, who's my co-host, will join you on the back line and welcome you into the show. But I want to talk to you about the National Association for Adult Survivors of Child Abuse because, as you know, NASCA is all about child abuse trauma prevention, intervention, and recovery. We have a single purpose at NASCA. It's to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas and neglect, and we do so with two goals. The first, educating the public, especially as related to helping society get over its taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, presenting facts showing child abuse to be a pandemic worldwide problem that affects everyone. The second goal, offering hope and healing through numerous paths, such as this show, providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse, and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. So once more, the number to call in is area code 646-595-2118. So before I bring our special guest Simon on and tell you a little bit about his background, he provided us with a really nice bio on his background. I want to tell you how special guest night show works. So we work the show in three segments. In the first segment, we begin and the show flows chronologically through the special guest's life. From the first segment, each segment's about 20 minutes, 15, 20 minutes. We will have Simon tell us about his earliest memories from birth to around the age of 18, a little bit of context about what his family life was like growing up, who were the members of his family, geography, and just some context, and take us through the life events as he remembers them up until the age of 18. We'll then break to the panel between the first and second segment, which is our panel is growing, and the panel will have an opportunity to ask a question or a comment around his story. Well, second segment is about the life in the ages 18 to 30 or so. We'll break again, and then the third segment is the healing process and what our special guest Simon is doing currently today and how things are going. So without further ado, I would like to tell you a little bit more about our special guest, Simon David. He's from Chicago, Illinois. And he states his mother was an early perpetrator, starting the sexual abuse when he was 5. And he states it ended at age 12. He says, therefore, I was and am a survivor of incest. I'm going to stop right there, and I am going to introduce our panel and then unmute Simon's microphone. So on our panel this evening, of course, is my co-host, Pamela Lockridge, also our show's producer. I know you all know Pamela. We have Mary Jane from Florida. We have Doug from Maryland. We have Kirsten from Texas. And we have a 312 number who is in listen-only mode. And we appreciate the listen, you calling in and listening and supporting our very special guests. So we will. I will have Pamela. She'll check in with you periodically to see if you have a question or comment and you want to be involved as we go into the rounds of the panels. But if not, please feel free to remain in listen-only mode. So, Simon, I'm going to unmute your microphone and welcome you onto the show this evening. Welcome.
Hello, hello, Pamela and Penelope and the radio audience. I feel very honored to be here. I first contacted NASCA, I think, a couple of months ago, and then I spoke with Pamela. And she said to me something I won't forget, I'd be glad to have more men involved. And that's the true thing about this issue. You don't hear about men with sexual abuse in their early years, and you also don't hear about female perpetrators too often. It has been written about, but it's just not the most common thing, and men are taught not to be vulnerable. But if we happen to have been, not through any fault of our own, then we have to deal with what happened. So to start from the beginning, I grew up elsewhere on the East Coast, and I had a very small family. The nuclear family, I'll call it, was my mother, father, and older sister. We lived in a, I don't know, relatively small apartment, and there was tension actually right away that I found out about, you know, later when I could understand that my mother was foreign-born from Southern Europe, and my father, she became a war bride, and he was in the Army, and they came over to the U.S. after his tour and married, and they didn't have a place to be, so they stayed with his parents, and there were tremendous tensions between my father's parents, my grandparents, and her. She was foreign and maybe of a different religion. And so they didn't approve of his choice and then probably an imposition to live in another small place. But they eventually got to where I grew up in a small apartment. It was now when I look back on it, the ages 5 to 12 were very confusing, and again, through no fault of my own. And the very first thing I remember, and all my memories are extremely clear. I mean, I can go into tremendous detail. I will basically outline things, but as I'm speaking, I'm remembering exactly the lighting in the rooms, what someone was wearing or not wearing, where things took place. So I'm somewhat unusual from other survivors I've met in that sometimes people block out a lot of the memories because they're very upset. Yeah. Did you say something?
I said yes. Yes, that's true.
Oh, okay. Yes, true. Yeah. And sometimes I've also read from clinical literature that you block it out so that you won't be overwhelmed. Some survivors first start to remember at the age of 40. But I remembered in my 20s, and I'll get to that, you know, the second segment. So the age of 5, my mother committed what is considered covert incest. And there's a difference between covert incest and overt. Overt, I believe, involves intercourse and things of that nature. But overt is just as serious and just as damaging, which can include touching, boundary invasions, seduction, even emotional abuse, which I'll also mention during my 5 through 12, emotional abuse psychologically. So there are so many violations. But at the age of 5, I was, of course, in first grade as a school student. And I remember getting up for school, going from my bed to the bathroom, and then I saw the door locked. So I knocked on the door, as I did have to go. And my mother said, come on in. And I can stop there and say she was quite declothed and asked me to do something that just so inappropriate. I mean, it's as gory as you can possibly get. So I'll stop there and say that was my first memory at the age of 5. And why should a young boy have to be exposed to his mother in the bathroom doing whatever? But that's what happened. And again, I remember it as clearly, clear as a bell. Now, during this early school period, from first grade to 6th, so I guess I was 5 and maybe 11, I was rather sickly, very sickly child. And that makes sense to me, because if something like that's going on and you're not from that standard nurturing mother household, as mothers are known to be, you're going to have physical and mental symptoms going to affect your body, your thoughts. And, you know, what is a young child to do? The only attention they get is from the mother, possibly the father. And what kind of attention was it? Well, boundary invasion after boundary invasion. Incredible. Mm-hmm. Just incredible. So when I was home too often, I'll go to a different type. Boundary problem, which was emotional, psychological. I remember being the age of 9, and my mother just made me a lunch in the kitchen, and I was sitting in a chair about to eat lunch that she had made. I was, again, fourth grade or so, and my mother began to share with me her personal problems with my father, with her best friend in the neighborhood, because she was from the same, born and from the same country, France, and problems with my grandmother, my father's mother, of her disapproval, and all of her personal problems. So, you know, I'm sitting there, I was dumbfounded. I mean, just, you know, listening and, you know, frozen as could possibly be. Now, you can imagine a 9-year-old handling an adult's problems. You know, all there could be was passivity on my part. You know, a 9-year-old isn't going to say, Mom, can you please stop? I want to eat lunch and you're telling me too much. I would say that now. But it didn't happen. So I often say that there's an effect today that I'll just briefly mention. I don't want to jump too much ahead. But I then became such a listener that I disappeared from showing up on the map, so to speak. I was listening too much to people who I met as an adult, and I didn't know how to talk about myself. All I did was hear their needy story upon first meeting. So I'll go back to that later. So that was an example of such inappropriate use emotions. Of course, she needed therapy, but, you know, my mother was so ill that, first of all, she was an alcoholic. That's another problem. Absolutely another problem. And it took drugs, took every kind of sleeping pill and tranquilizer you can name. So she was very out of sorts, you know, obviously would have blackouts, things she didn't remember, things she didn't want to remember. And I used to, again, another memory, as clear as anything, was I lived across from a community center, and on Friday nights, I used to get a call on the house phone that my friend said, "Why don't you come across the street? We're having a party, and you'll, there's soda and food and everything. So come." And I said, "No, I'm sorry, I just can't." Why? I felt like I had to watch my mother. Was she going to do something destructively? Because often when I was home, I would see her leaning out of the window a little bit too far. And I used to think, she's about to jump. How did I know? Also, in terms of the alcoholism, she had drinks scattered all around the house. So as an inquisitive youngster, I found alcohol in glasses, in cups, inside the refrigerator, underneath kitchen cabinets, underneath the bathroom sink, underneath beds. So I'm going through every room here. And, I said, confused, like, what is all this? And then one time I saw her passed out on the bathroom floor. Again, what am I going to do? Act like an adult? No, I was 9 years old. So the one person I then shared this with was my father would get home from work. And I would say, "Dad, I found Mom on the floor today, and I found, all these drinks. What's going on?" Say again?
I don't think that was intended, maybe.
I'll get back. Yeah. So when I shared this with my father, he assured me, there's nothing wrong. Don't worry about it. So again, the effect was I learned to not trust my own judgments. He did not validate anything that I shared. And that was later to be true about the worst things and alcohol, finding drinks around the house. So this was, again, a typical scene of my father denying anything, covering things up, sweeping things under the rug. And my mother and father, when I was that age, they used to go into the bedroom when he got back, and they would have a drink or two. That was a routine. Then we would have a late dinner. And was there fighting at the table? Absolutely. My mother, again, out of sorts. My sister was at odds with her. My father was very quiet and very passive. And I was sitting there watching this family dynamic that I could later understand was dysfunctional at the very least. So I've mentioned the finding of drinks and wondering what's going on, the invalidation. There's another thing that came to pass. Again, when I was around 9 and 10, when I would be home, or possibly it was even the summer when I was home the full time in July and August, my mother would say, "Simon, come in the bedroom. I'm going to make our bed." And my father was absent. My sister was absent. So she took me by the hand, she said, "Hold this sheet." So it was like holding the sheet two sides on one side and then her holding the other. But that was not what she had in mind. She, after a while, pulled me in to the middle of the bed and held me very close and started to kiss me all over. So, again, as a passive child who knew no better, I mean, the body language was, "Oh, my goodness, get me out of here." This is really just so awful to even talk about this today. But I am, and I'm not getting re-traumatized, that I have good control, and I share these things in chosen places. So I deal with it all the time, and I'm fine. So I'm perfectly glad to share these things. So this was a seductive act, a absolutely seductive act, and this was not the first time. Then I'm recalling another scene, And I'll try not to give, again, too many details. But when I was, again, before 10, somewhere like 8, 7, 8, whenever I was toilet trained, and I don't even know when that is, the exact ages, for some reason, I didn't want to sit on the toilet seat. I liked the cold feeling of the bowl. So I would sit directly on the bowl. And as a result, I contracted pinworms. Okay. What does a normal family do? What does a normal parent do? Well, you consult the doctor and, you know, there's medication for that or there's some other treatment. No. My mother started to play doctor and, you know, examine me, you know, where these were. And, you know, you can sort of surmise what I would say next. I'm just not going to. But she invaded my physical boundaries in trying to find where they were. Isn't this just ridiculous? It's amazing. That memory is so clear. Again, I knew where I was in the bed. I knew what she did. And again, if I were to see the body language of a child, it was, what is she doing? Get me out of here. Okay. Another thing. I remember being 11, going up to 11. I used to take baths in the bathroom. So I was slightly pre-pubescent. And there I was in the bathtub. My mother would come in after 15 minutes or so and begin to dry me off at the age of 11, coming into the bathroom to towel off the young man who's developing secondary sexual characteristics, body hair, whatever. Again, you know, I'm going to repeat, body language, oh my goodness, what is she doing? You know, and so this happened all the time. Another prime example of boundary invasion after boundary invasion. Physical, it was considered covert incest, because my mother was gathering pleasure in handling her little boy. And because if these had been isolated incidents, that's one thing. But I found out that she was having trouble with my father, and between all the criticism of his parents about their marriage, it was criticism to that day. And she always felt the pressure of my father not supporting her. So this came out in therapy in my 20s. Again, I'll go into that later. But I found out that there were marital problems in that he didn't take the side of my mother. He took the side of his mother. So my mother was extremely angry about this. And as a result, formed a little relationship with a young, innocent, healthy boy. And boy, what a job that did on my health, which again, I'll go into later about health effects and mental effects. So I've named quite a few things that come to memory, but believe me, there were so many more. So maybe I can pause a while and people can take that in.
Well, and I just have to say, you are articulating your story so well, and clearly, no pun intended, you're very clear on the events. I mean, you mentioned that you did not remember dissociating, which is more of it's a common phenomenon for children, but you were very, very aware and very present in every respect, with the memory, with the atmosphere, with the feelings, physical and emotional sensations. I'm a little bit flabbergasted, and I do want to say, you know, thank you for being so thorough with your descriptions, because that really helps so many people that are listening, because I do believe that there still is a lot of times just some not clarity around how, and you did such a good job, incest and molestation within, you know, within the family and outside the family is defined. And you know, the covert versus the overt. And so by you providing the examples and providing the definitions, you know, it's helping others to understand, that maybe want to just know more about the subject, and it's helping others that are either on the panel or and both on the panel and listening in, streaming in, because there's a lot of minimization that goes on, or, oh, it was just this, it was not big of a deal, or only it only happened just once, or it wasn't, you know, overt. I think it really helps to put some framework around that. We live in a society that minimizes, you know, the subject, as you know. So I just wanted to say, you know, thank you for that. And as you're saying, and I'm going to start to go down the panel now, but as if you're telling your story, I can tell you so much of it resonated with myself. I was molested by my father. And to your point, I mean, your mother, clearly you were filling an unmet, a lot of unmet emotional needs that your mother had, which is obviously something that a child should never have to endure and experience. And the fact that your father, you were minimized, he minimized everything that was going on. You had no validation. And to have to parent your parent at such a young age when you already have not been nurtured, you really have nothing to give. You know, you've not been filled with the nurturing, as you mentioned, and the, you know, and all the feeling that your parent is present in every respect, that helps build your, you know, your esteem. When that is then taken from you, when you have to parent your parent, it's almost that, you know, you're almost bankrupt already, and that someone's taking something more from you, and how just damaging that is. And you did a really good job of explaining that. And I've referenced this article before, and I don't know, Simon, if you've actually read this article, but when I first was able to speak of the fact that my own father molested me, I was very curious, and it sounds like, I know you were an educator, if I remember correctly, in profession.
Yes, I began teaching. Teaching in my early 20s, and then I became a counselor again.
Okay. So you have some, I remember the teacher, now a counselor, and so obviously you like to look, you've mentioned looking at some of the clinical data. I remember wanting to know, I just wanted to know why a father would molest. And I found an article, of all things, in the Oklahoman newspaper. And it sort of built the profile, the characteristics, if you will, of a man. This is obviously, I was looking for fathers molesting their daughters. So yours would obviously be, a mother molesting his son. But you know, they're well-educated, you know, middle class. This is just the profile that was built. But the thing that really resonated with me, and this actually resonated with me as you were telling your story, that the partner for these men, they were either absent emotionally or mentally ill, right? There was a lack of emotional attachment, and that the father then looked to the daughter to fill that need. And it sounds to me like that in your account of your childhood, and that resonated with me as well. And it doesn't always have to be, like you said, it can be covert and not overt, and that sometimes these things then evolve into overt from covert. So thank you for sharing what you've shared, and I will open up the line to Pamela and invite Pamela, and I'm sure she has some questions and comments for you. So Pamela, maybe you're on mute if you want to ask Simon a question or you have a comment. Okay, and Simon, you're there, aren't you?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. I'm like, is it my line? You know, you just never know, right? Well, let's come back to Pamela. So I'm going to actually invite Mary.
I'm here, Pamela.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I didn't know if you had.
That was very interesting what you were talking about the absence, emotionally absent, or, you know, having mental illness in the family and just being dysfunctional in general. You know, and just having that tension in the house, you know, I could see how the abuser, even though it's totally wrong, Simon, the abuser tried to you know, make some kind of a way with you to make it, like, you know, good for them. You understand what I'm saying? Somehow this pleased her in some way, that disgusting way that we'll never understand, right? That it, she got pleasure out of it. And, you know, one of the reasons when I ask men to come on to the show, and more men are coming on to the show, and this is an adult show, okay? And, you know, the more we open up and the more information we give, the more, you know, others will open up even more. And so if you don't want to answer this question, I totally understand. But when you were in the bathroom and your mother was in the bathroom and then she brought you in the bathroom, could you explain what she did? Because it is an adult show, and, you know, we want to, because this show is going to be archived and other people will listen to shows before they come on, and we want them to be able to explain what happened. You know, it's one thing to say I was sexually abused. Well, that's so broad and so general, you know. And I think sometimes we need to get to specifics so people understand what we really went through.
I have no problem answering, actually. I'm fine with you asking. I would preface it, though, by saying something. I've gone to some adult self-help groups fairly in the present, maybe the last 2 or 3 years. And I attempted to share this particular memory. And in a few of the groups, a number of people actually got triggered, and they had to raise their hand and say, can you please stop? And those were the rules of the group. And, you know, it was resolved by my stopping sharing, or it was decided they have to leave the group and come back. But mainly I just didn't share that. So that, I, you know, it can be very triggering to people. But I do understand, you know, it helps to be specific. Okay. Well, I was late for school, and I had to, so she said, come on in, Simon. And there she is sitting on the toilet, you know, with her pubic hair exposed. And she says, I pointed to my penis at that time, very small, which was saying, I have to go, Mom. So she says, okay, Dan, okay, Simon, pee between my legs. So first of all, before I did, I saw, you know, red coloring in the toilet water. That was blood, obviously. And then I saw the pubic hair, her bush, her and it fascinated me. I was looking at it saying, wow, what is that? And at the same time, being fascinated with it, I was also thinking, yeah, that looks like dirt. So I did pee between her legs and then just, you know, got dressed and went to school. So that's exactly what happened. And, you know, how ridiculous that is. And perhaps the effect, I'm surprised that I didn't get turned off by women and during a sexual act, you know, in my adult years, I was not turned off. That surprised me because I thought, oh, my goodness, if I ever get into a sexual situation, I'm going to freak out and say, oh, I can't do this. You know, something will happen. But so far it has not happened, thank God.
Awesome. Well, what about when you were a little bit older, like you said, nine-ish, and she had the sheet and you got in the bed? What happened there, if you don't mind telling us?
Well, she would clutch me from behind, put her arms around me, start kissing me on the side of the neck and ears. And I just remember putting my hands across my crotch area, you know, closing up. I was frozen, as I was with many other things, all the bathroom scenes, the kitchen scenes, the different room scenes. I was saying, you know, what is going on here? I didn't want that. It was unwanted touch, unwanted close emotional intimacy from an adult to a child. That's what happened.
And you were able to stop her, whatever she wanted to do at that point?
No. She stopped when she wanted. So that's it's almost like you hear these stories of kids being locked up in basements and things. They're released, or I was released when she was finished. So I had to then go about my way. So no control on my part, that's for sure.
Right. Well, you know, I just, you know, we as women, and there's so many women's stories, you know, we all know what men do to women, but it's very rare understand what men can do to men. And I think we need to start opening up with that. And so I want to thank you for going there. You know, I know it's got to be hard for you. And I'm going to leave it at that. And thank you, Simon.
Certainly. Certainly.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you, Pamela. And thank you, Simon. I'm going to bring on Mary Jane from Florida, and I'm going to unmute your mic. So, Mary Jane, you are on with our guest, Simon.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
We are just here to support you, and thank you for sharing your story. Now we know what you are going through your childhood, and we just want you to know that we're always here for you no matter what. Okay?
Okay.
Oh, very sweet. Thank you, Mary Jane. Thank you. I'm going to put you
thank
back
you.
On Listen Only, and I'm going to bring Doug from Maryland and unmute your mic. Doug, good evening, and thank you for calling and supporting Simon tonight. You are on with him.
Thank you. I want to thank you for sharing. And then all I can say is my mother did things to me that were horrible, and both my parents used to cry to me about all their problems and everything, and I hated that, and that's all I really have to add.
Thank you for sharing.
Yeah.
Thank you, Doug. Thank you for, you know, calling to support Simon, and I appreciate what you just shared as well. I think, you know, the message here too is that, you know, we do need more men, and I'm so pleased that we are starting to see that trend a little bit more, at least here at NASCA, that Simon's on, and Doug, you have, you know, called and support him to let him know he's not alone in what you just shared. So thank you. Thank you for that. I'm moving Kirsten from Texas on. Kirsten, you are on.
Hi, Simon. I just wanted to say thank you. It's very commendable that you're sharing your story. I actually had a question. I know that Penelope had mentioned that you did not experience a disassociation. What then did you do to be able to deal with such overwhelming abuse? I mean, what was your
very good, very good question. Very good question. Yes, because as Pamela said, it's very common. There's a condition called dissociative identity disorder. The old name was multiple personality disorder. And where some, in a way, floats up to the ceiling, you like you almost separate from your body, and you're looking down at the terrible thing going on, but just separated. But that's a different thing that happened to me. I simply had such an internal perhaps strong system, as it turned out. I didn't think so for many years, but I was very strong. I had internalized all that. Of course, that led to rage. But before that, my method was, again, almost like training. My adaptation was, before the age of 12, I was always encouraging the family to gather around and have family meetings, almost like I was a psychiatrist. So, in other words, I bore the pain. I knew something was wrong. But I was mainly thinking, oh, our parents' marriage is not good. And I said to myself, you know, I'd never marry a woman like my mother, and I would never marry a man like my father. That's what I thought at the age of 10. And at the same age, I'm saying, why don't we have family meetings where we, you know, air out our feelings? So a 12-year-old psychiatrist, that's how I handled things internally.
Wow. Wow, that's and you're a counselor today?
Well, I have interesting. I have a master's in school counseling, and I was in a school system in which I was part, did about 8 years teaching, 9 years counseling. And then in 1988, I applied for a certification as a nationally certified counselor, which I still am today. My license is good from 1988 through 2024. And I've done a lot of studying. I never went into adult counseling. I stayed with the schools. I have this certificate that is a license from an official board in North Carolina. So I could have opened up my own private practice. The reason I did not is that I wanted to concentrate on my own recovery. You know, I believe me, in my life, I have met many therapists who were social workers who were in a way using the client to work out their own problems. That's cardinal sin of social work and therapy. But I didn't want to be that type. So in a way, I was very responsible and said, you know what, at the point where I'm very, with good boundaries and very clear on myself, I could go into counseling. I'm as good as any psychiatrist to this day.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for being on tonight.
Yeah. Thank you for those questions. Those are great.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you, Kirsten. Those are great. Thank you. And thank you for supporting Simon tonight. I'm going to put you back on the Sonoli mode. We do have another caller who's just listening in, so I'm going to leave that caller to listen. But just to know, Simon, that you have a lot of support on the panel. We have a very, very robust panel this evening supporting you in your story. So, and as Pamela, I always say 90 minutes seems like a long time, but it just flies by. And believe it or not, we're almost halfway through the show. So in entering the second segment, I'll obviously, you know, turn it over to you and just, you know, fill us in about, you know, those later teenage years up until around the age of 30. And you mentioned some internal rage, and I'm not sure when that's going to come up, but I'll just give you the floor, and let's try it. I guess maybe go about, you know, at about a 20-minute mark. I might, if you haven't decided to pause, we might pause so we have another opportunity to go to the panel. That's okay with you, Simon?
Sure. Sounds like good structure.
Okay.
Well, before I get into 18, I briefly would go into a couple of other effects that were from the 5 to 12. They were very germane, really important. And then I'll go right into the 18. I know I have a tendency to be very wordy, tell some long stories, but, you know, as feedback I'm getting is that I'm pretty clear and it's, you know, stimulating discussion questions. First of all, obviously, I had a terrible body image. The body, and you hear this about women, you know, feeling they have to be slim and all that sort of thing. But I was overweight in my elementary years while the incest was going on. Strangely enough, I changed into a string bean for the three junior high years, 12 to 15. Then I gained weight again when I went to high school, where most people start to go out. You know, I'll go into that in a moment. So I was, you know, terrible body image, terrible. And that lasted through a long time. The other thing was when in elementary school, while this terrible stuff was going on, I couldn't bring any friends over school it was very common that kids would go over and play, stay over a weekend, you know, sleep over. I couldn't do that because I was ashamed of my mother. You know, obviously, I'm going to bring home a friend to, so that they can see an out-of-sorts mother who's hovering around the house, half drunk and withdrawn. No. So shame came up, not just guilt, shame. A lot of shame in this. So I really felt awkward a lot until, you know, well through high school. So then, okay, so let me go to the, strangely enough, the junior high years, not strangely enough, 12 one and a half through 15, I was free as a bird. That was actually a wild time in most junior high years with the body changing and the hormones going wild. I had a great time because I was free. I was free as a bird. But, of course, all the feelings were internal. I was later to deal with that. But 12 through 15 was very pleasurable. Then we came to high school where I starting at 15 through 18. So after the graduation from junior high. And junior high was very personal, very small amount of students. I was going to go to a high school that had 5,000 students, and I had to travel far with public transit. And I was literally afraid of going there because I had heard rumors about gangs. And when I grew up, these tough guys were called hitters, you know, the leather jackets type on motorcycles. And, you know, that was really true. They were there. So I was literally afraid, and I was very withdrawn. I believe that depression had started way back, actually. Depression, very major depression, very deep depression, started actually before high school when I slept an entire summer from my sixth grade year going into junior high. Then it started right then. I still have that condition today, though many people wouldn't be able to tell. So going to high school as a freshman, again, I was just overwhelmed by the social scene. And I was extremely uncomfortable. I was ashamed to get undressed in gym. I felt, again, very awkward with the body. And, of course, this was the time where high school dances were taking place and parties and there are girlfriends, boyfriends, combinations. I distinctly remember that I screened out all sexual words, all sexual conversation, all social conversation, which is very normal for that age. People, are meeting, dating, exploring sex, or at least talking about sex, or fantasizing, and sharing with their friends. Well, not me, not here. I screened out every possible sexual word. I mean, it was not like I walked around with blinders and earplugs. So in thinking about that, it was probably a good reason for that. Again, was this my fault? No. So I didn't have a normal social life when I went through high school, 15 through 18. It was just awful. And I was, you know, so ashamed of myself. And I just can't tell you how damaging that is when I look back. So I missed all that period. I really did. So if I were to use some of the words things that I felt, I was ashamed, I was humiliated, afraid, unsure, tense, worried, angry. I was confused. I was terrified. These are such horrible things to be feeling rather than, you know, going out, having a good time and socializing. I became a very late bloomer, extremely late bloomer. So I'm trying to think if there's anything else with high school. Maybe my only saving grace was I played on a couple of sports teams, and sometimes the camaraderie was good there. And that was about the only thing that I remember being positive. But the insecurity feeling just really never left me. So then I, of course, went to college from age of 18 through 22. And I went to a very interesting school, a kind of not a very difficult school academically, but more of a social school. And again, social life was the key. You know, what were college students doing? They were living at the dorm, partying, staying up late, going to classes, going to the food and hangout hall, and socializing. Well, my only form of socialization was a fraternity. And I had fraternity brothers, and that actually was, you know, that was a very good thing. But again, what did I focus on? Many of the fraternity brothers were dating the sister sorority, and I was only observant of that. I didn't participate. Mm-hmm. I had no feelings whatsoever. I was very frozen, very withdrawn, always the observer, not the doer. So again, in looking back, I had felt so awkward coming into college, and you know, college is a big social experience, expanding from high school. So, and again, the only thing was I played on a couple of sports teams. That was about it. Finally, in my senior year, one of my fraternity brothers set me up on a date with a beautiful girl, and that was like my first time, and it was just that was wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. Let's see. I wish that had happened earlier, but I was so awkward. Now, you talk about the anger involved. Anger was not yet expressed. It was very internal. So at the age of 22, upon graduating college, I graduated with a Bachelor of Arts and with a minor in education, so I would teach. I taught mathematics. I came into the school system in a way very unprepared for life skills and living. I was still living at home in my first year of work in the public school, but I was really freaked out by the city schools. I mean, I was literally, again, afraid, very insecure. So I went to therapy. A therapy center on my own. I really could have used it in college and probably even high school, but there weren't really, you know, counselors only, you know, saw the student the first day of school and then what courses they're going to take and what they need to graduate high school. But in college, there was a counseling service, but I was too ashamed to go down to a basement where the psychology department offered counseling. But I did go at the age, in the early 20s, to a therapist who was a CSW at the time, a man. And he seemed like very good. He was a social worker in the school, and then he had his own practice after three through six or seven. So I contracted to see him weekly. And with this man, I stayed 5 years in therapy, my first therapy experience. In middle 20s, I had been there with 3 years of my five, I said to the therapist, you know, and I explained in detail about my mother's drinking and, my awkwardness with myself and my fear about the students at the school where I was working, and you know, kind of a toughened bunch, and I was this mild-mannered guy held back. And I shared the first incest scene, the first incest covert scene that I had, where I answered Pamela's question about the bathroom incident. And mm-hmm. After my sharing this, the therapist said the most horrible thing. He said, Simon, you have such a vivid imagination. You must have fabricated this. So, you know, I said to myself, fabricated this? No, but I left the session a little dumbfounded. I said, well, he's the therapist. I guess he knows best. So there I was in my middle 20s. I had shared the story. I was ready to deal with the horrors of what had happened to me. But this man ended up repressing my memories for 12 years. I did not deal with it nor remember until I was in my late 30s. And a very interesting thing was the trigger, the most interesting thing. after my teaching days and after, you know, 5 years with him, I took a rest from therapy and but I would go back on and off. I was training to be a counselor. I had gotten my master's degree in school counseling with my licenses. And I found one employer that was not in the public school, but they were a non-public school program. It was a great program to start as a counselor. And the deal was we went into the Catholic schools and we gave service as counseling one-on-one, counseling small groups, counseling an entire classroom. I loved it. And the deal was once a month, the counselors met for a training and then to share what's going on in their assignments. So what did I come upon in my late 30s, my first year working as a counselor? There was a psychodrama. The training was a woman, had three children, one son, two daughters, and she was sitting on stage, and the stage was set, and they showed inappropriate touching on the part of the mother toward the children and inappropriate conversation. Mm-hmm. In between, they would stop after one scene and say, well, these are the characteristics of incest survivors, of children who have survived sexual abuse by their parents, not by a stranger, by a parent. Difference from sexual abuse from a stranger, from family member, that's incest. So there I am furiously writing down all my characteristics and writing down, dissociation, withdrawal, depression, blah, blah, blah. And I got to number 26 of 36, and I started to shake. I had a psychosomatic mm-hmm. reaction, and I was sitting in the middle of the auditorium with my fellow counselors taking notes. I started to sweat profusely, sweating in the whole body. I felt my pulse, and I said, oh, my goodness, I'm having a heart attack. And so I was so ashamed, I left my notebook there and I walked out to escape, you know, without being looked at. And I walked outside and I said, oh, my God, what is happening here? And, you know, I calmed down after, you know, I waited, I don't know, 10 or 15 minutes. And the sweating was still going on. The pulse was still racing. But I dried myself off and I said, well, I have to go back in there. So I finished the training. And then I ran to the public school's counseling service that was given to any personnel that had to go there. But it was really mainly geared towards drug rehab, 12-step program type counseling. So it really wasn't geared for that. But I did go, shared that with someone I was assigned, and I was terribly afraid there would be confidentiality matters, and actually there were, because they had to send the report that I was having services I don't know where it went, but it was on my record somewhere. And I didn't like that when I found out about that. But never, and again, that's another boundary problem. But be that as it may, to get back to when I started therapy again with not just the public schools counselor, I got in touch with my rage. Because it wasn't just anger, it was rage. And I said this to a self-help group member many years later. Most people, especially women, are afraid or they can't access their anger. They're usually sad and perhaps depressed and withdrawn. If they can, they get in touch with anger first. Men, on the other hand, get in touch with anger and possibly are vulnerable to experience sadness. I don't know what order it was, but I remember getting in touch with rage to the point that when I used the vocabulary, I confronted my parents in front of my sister and them and shouted to the point of, you know, breaking glass to say, you this and you that, I know what you did and you're not going to get away with it. I'm considering suing you and so forth, which I actually really did consider. There were reports of women suing their parents, and they hired a specialized lawyer from California who's well known. But I consider that. But the better thing was I got in touch with my rage. I'd go back to the therapist and say, you know, I confronted my parents this weekend, but it felt awful. But I did that for a number of years. And getting back to what I shared with the self-help group was, I said, most people are very afraid of people's anger or their own. I've become very comfortable with my own anger. Therefore, I am not uncomfortable with anybody's anger. And that is true today. I do not freeze when there's an angry person around or even a near violent incident. I'm very calm. And the other aspect of that is, I said to the self-help members, I said, you know that getting in touch with my rage actually saved me. I'm not against rage. I was so internalized, you know, being the family psychiatrist and never expressing this anger in a way that would get it externalized and, of course, causing so much deep depression. And when I got in touch with that rage, I externalized it. I never threw a chair. I never punched anybody, never threw pots and pans, but I had a voice that was piercing as could be. So when I was angry, in touch with that rage, boy, they knew it. And then people, of course, scatter. The negative thing is people don't listen, and that could be true today. They all they hear is the force of the words, so they get scared. So no one's listening at that point. But it did something for me, and I had to go through that step, and I'm very glad I did. So I repeat again, my extreme anger, rage saved me. And this went through my 30s, and I could say up to the present day. And maybe, would you say I should pause here and, you know, you go to your other segment?
Well, I think, yeah, I think this is a good place to pause. And I just want to say, wow, okay, you're so articulate. And I felt like I was walking your journey with you, Simon, honestly. And I just have to say, in the point in the second segment when you said, you know, in college you had taken advantage of some services and you had started speaking to the same therapist for, you know, 3 out of 5 years. And it sounds to me like if you're speaking to someone for 3 years, you trust them. You've built some trust. You keep going back. You're finding some benefit, and there's obviously some trust there. And I think from what I'm just, maybe I'm reading between the lines or just interjecting myself into your story, but for you to be able to tell for the first time about the covert incest to someone that you built that much trust with, to have that person tell you that you fabricated it. I've never felt my own anger, and I don't want to talk about me and talk about women. I felt anger for you in that moment, like really angry. At the same time, I'm so relieved that it sounds like you were so determined to get it out no matter what. You were triggered during that note-taking session of that role play where the mother was demonstrating to the children that incest. But I was cheering that you were still able to push that forward, albeit so many years later. So those are just some comments, not really a question. But I think, you know, that for me, there's just, that's, I'm happy for you that you were able to, you know, not suppress that to the point where, you know, it either didn't come out or it took so much longer. But still angry, very angry. And that's part of me wonders if that counselor couldn't face his own truth and minimize yours. I don't know. Only you would know, or he would know, or she would know.
Yeah, you can share more, but I want to interject something. Not to give an excuse, but in those years, this was the 1970s, this is going on, I don't think the information was really out there about openly. Things were, of course, happening with children and families, but it was never out in the open. So I don't think he was really trained in his social work program and his own counseling that, you know, to handle this. But nevertheless, years later, I said, you know, about this therapist, if I were me today, I would say I would recommend his license be taken away. You cannot do that. You have to make sure you understand that particular issue. It's a major issue. You shouldn't be in practice unless you do something about it.
I agree. Or at least this is not my area of expertise. I don't have knowledge in this. Maybe even refer you, right? Not just
yes.
Tell you it's fabricated. I mean, that was such an injustice.
Yes.
Even if he didn't.
Oh, and I forgot to mention, I'm sorry, Penelope, forgot to mention, you were right on target about this was a tremendous betrayal. Betrayal by a trusting, I had trusted this man. I opened up about many things about me. It was a betrayal right at that moment, in a way matching the betrayal of actually my father, even more than my mother. I forgot to say, and it's true with me and others, that the perpetrator you're furious with, but if you have a parent that didn't protect you, he didn't, he shoved it under the rug, oh, everything's fine. We have a wonderful marriage. We have a wonderful family. A lot of BS. So if you push it under the rug and you don't protect your child, that's what a father's supposed to do. So I wasn't very satisfied with my father. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but that was important to say.
No, not at all. Absolutely. No, it's your show. And absolutely, that's, you know, your father not only neglected you, to me that's torture because he threw you back into the wolves with your mother.
Yeah, exactly.
Pamela, I'm going to invite you back in the conversation. This is our last round of the panel, and we have 23 minutes left, so I would like to also add, as an aside, please just limit your question or comment to be brief. I'd like maybe to give each panel member about a minute so we can go on to the third segment. So without further ado, Pamela, inviting you back in.
Okay. Yeah, we need to keep it short, I know. So you're doing great, Mr. Simon, and I'm so proud of you for, you know, this is going to be part of your continued healing journey, you know. And, whenever you confronted your parents, did you come out with all of it to them at once? I mean, the sexual abuse, how you had to be the parent. I mean, did you just unload it all on them?
Yes, in a few visits on a weekend, yes. I let them have it to the point that, I mean, I really got to the point. I had been so out of my shell from good therapy at that time that I
and
blasted
your
them to the
father point. Learned of the incest and all that, right?
He's, no, to this day, I mean, he passed away, unfortunately, 3-4 years ago. But in his lifetime, he never acknowledged that this happened. His comment was to me, my response is interesting. He said, you know, you really kind of, another invalidation. He said, you know, your mother was just giving you European mothering. You know, they're much freer there. I said, yeah, European incest is the same as American incest. So there.
Good comment. Great comment. Yeah. So what did she say? What was her, did she admit it?
No, oh, no. The statistics are that, you know, 97 to 99% of parents never acknowledge that. They would never. No, neither did. It was denial on my father's part, my mother's part. She continued to rage. And then there's an interesting thing my sister did. My sister did notice things. She even blurted out things like, when my mother would parade around half nude, she said, this is inappropriate. You know, he's going to be affected. But in later years, when I went to live on my own and I joined my sister in her own neighborhood, I thought, oh, we're going to get together occasionally. And I'd like to discuss, you know, our parents and what went wrong and, you know, how such as this. That's all you want to do is discuss the past. I don't want to hear about that, and you're not going to just drop over here, and I don't want you to meet my friends. You know, you're on your own.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the kind of combative relationship I had with a sister. But she did realize, but she then went into denial. So 3-1.
Just one yes or no question. Are you still in therapy?
Yes. I just started with someone who was extremely trauma-informed. Yes, I am.
Okay. All right. Thank you. That's great.
Thank you, Pamela, and thank you, Simon. All right. I'm going to bring Mary Jane from Florida back on. Mary Jane, you are on with Simon.
Hi.
Hello.
My question is, are you
you will be able to trust anyone ever again after all this happened to you?
Well, it's a great question. In general, I still don't trust people until I see that they're able to listen, that they repeat back to me that they've understood. And I have found, you know, if I found a handful of people current life, that would be a lot. But I have trouble with real personal relationships, and I just can't seem to trust very easily.
That's good.
Well, thank you. Good question. Thank you, Mary Jane. I'm going to bring on Doug. Doug from Maryland. Doug, you're back on with Simon. So, Doug, I've unmuted your line. If you're still there, you wish to have a quick question or comment for Simon, you may do so. Okay.
Doug,
well, I will.
Yeah,
so I will put Doug back on mute, and I'm going to bring in Kirsten from Texas. And Kirsten, you're back on with Simon.
Simon, a real quick question. When you have faced your rage, what are some healthy ways that you have let out your rage?
Well, it's my opinion that rage must be expressed. It shouldn't be internalized. However, mm-hmm. if anybody lived with me here, they'd probably, you know, run away fast, because sometimes on a daily basis, I'm alone in my house. I have bought a large house. So it's all me, which I hope to change someday. But currently, I'm single and I'm there. When something bothers me about technology, or I'm on a phone with a phone representative of a building company that's double billed me, I lose my patience real quickly, and I shout to the walls. I say, whatever. I just, you know, again, I can almost break glass, but there's no harm. The neighbors don't hear. There's nobody here that would run away. But I let it out fast, and it's gone.
Yeah. Yeah, I have actually been in touch with, I've had rage myself, and sometimes I'll just literally get in my car and I'll park somewhere and I'll just literally scream as loud as I can, or say words that I wanted to say to my parents or whoever. I've found myself doing that, and then the next day I can't talk because my voice is gone. And people ask, like, oh, what happened to your voice? I'm like, oh, allergies, you know. Yeah. So I can scream pretty loud, but I was just thinking, I wonder if there was other ways to get rage out, because sometimes it feels like it needs to come out.
Yes, it's something that I've not neglected, but I always wanted to get into some sort of a martial art training, because,
yeah.
For instance, you know, when you give the ki, the punch, and the, you know, you grunt and so forth. Physical, it's well known, physical things would really help. So I
yeah.
do some exercise, but nothing vigorous like that. But that
yeah.
would be great.
That probably would be good.
Yeah,
yeah,
it would be excellent. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much, Simon.
Sure. And by the way, a car with the windows rolled up is a very good place to scream.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you, Chris. And that's a good, yeah, actually, that's my preferred venue for screaming, by the way, in the car driving. And hopefully there's no oncoming traffic, so, you know, nobody wonders what's going on. But I have found that's the best place for me. So with 15 minutes left, I don't want to short you on this third segment, because, you know, from what you provided us with your bio, it sounds like you have some future plans in terms of public speaking, and you've done some writing. And so I wanted to, you know, turn at least the next 10 minutes back over to you, Simon, and let us know, you know, what you wish to tell us in the last 10 minutes.
Oh, thank you very much. Boy, as you said, this is the fastest hour and a half in radio. it shows you there's so much material. And it's been absolutely wonderful. Well, currently, let me start presently and I'll work back a little. I have a lot of hope, really. I mean, having come from a most disastrous situation, I have recovered to the point that I still have many concerns, but there's a saying, you were at one time a victim, now you're a survivor, and you can thrive. Victim, survivor, thriver. And that's very true. And I've shared with some people who know a little bit about me that in many areas of my life, I'm thriving. The one area that I still feel insecure or incomplete is a personal relationship. I always felt that I wanted to have a personal one-on-one intimate relationship, possibly even a family. And I felt like with the terrible fathering I had, I would be a natural father, and having the experience in all the levels, K through 12, seeing normal developments, I would be a great father, and I think I'd be a great husband and partner. I feel like I have very good relationship skills. Certainly you can hear how I communicate. And I also, I know that couples go through problems. There's no perfect marriage. There are always going to be differences, but I feel prepared that if it should come to pass, anytime in the next few years, I'm prepared for understanding that people have differences. They speak different love languages. They have different friends. They have different interests. But if you both partners are willing to grow together and discuss things when they come up and be honest about it, then I think, you have skills. So I'm surprised that I haven't really connected the way I want, but I'm not surprised because I've gone to meetings where people discuss that they have a very bad radar for partners, romantic and sexual partners. And I share the same. I've had some very heartbreaking matters. But recently, I'm not worried about it. I'm having an interesting life. Every day is basically structured. I'm doing some things that are obligatory, but then I'm scheduling fun and hobbies and things that I love to do. And I'm always discovering new things, too, that I like. But getting back to the word hope, I have a lot of hope. And I've earned all that because I've done enormous amounts of healing work. I mean, again, I would need a whole show to tell you. But having started the one-to-one therapy, I remember working through so many things. And it's important to say that probably the best therapy I ever had lasted only about 15 months. And the style of therapy was I met a woman who was very motherly, and she did what's called reparenting. And obviously, I responded to this much more than, sitting there discussing, behavioral issue, behavioral counseling. They all have value. All therapy does. But this particular reparenting therapist acted like my mother, and it can be controversial. It's, a person can have boundary problems. But if they don't have boundary problems, it can be very healing. So therapy has helped me, but talking with my peers is so valuable. And I don't think it's a breach of confidentiality, but when I, a couple of years ago, I discovered a meeting here in Chicago, and it happened to be ASCA. But ASCA has nothing to do with this national association, a group called Adult Survivors of Childhood Abuse. And they're a non-12-step program. They're not only in Chicago, but I found out they're in other cities, and they have many meetings. And it has a wonderful approach. It has a very good structure. People can share. They can give a lead. They have very that's where I heard the term victim, survivor, thriver. So I gained a lot from that. I'm no longer going. But my current meeting is a 12-step program that you would think would be hard to go into. It's on the model of AA. but it's adapted. The steps are adapted to incest survivors. That's a wonderful meeting. That we're a small meeting. We share a lot very intimately. It's all confidential. Nobody gets triggered. We all understand each other. And so I do that once a week. It's wonderful. So I'm still doing that work. I just started with a trauma-informed therapist. She is outstanding. You can tell when a therapist is outstanding and works for you when they repeat back to you something that you say, well, that's exactly what I said. Number two, they'll ask a very key question or make a very key insight that a regular therapist who really is not trained in trauma, they have no concept. So this woman and I, we're with hourly sessions virtually right now. I may eventually see her. But so I have that, that group. I'm doing other healing work that involves writing. I think I shared that I wrote two short stories. They're not really so short, but I kept them. They're in my files, you know, in document files. But I'm very proud. I printed out some copies. It's not something I'm going to publish or share outside, but these, strangely enough, or not strangely enough, I got the idea somehow that there were a number of things I never worked through as a teenager, and a lot of it was the social stuff and the body image. So I wrote a couple of stories that had many characters in them, you know, character 1, 2, 3, and 4. All of them represented me, different parts of me. So, I was frozen at the age of 8 and 13 and 16 and 21. So all of them really are a story about my feelings at those ages. And all the characters have different names, but they're all me. So I wrote two different stories, and I find writing terribly therapeutic. And it's always advised that people who go to therapy or have sexual abuse problems, keep a journal. It's something that's very valuable, and the journal is for you. If you wish to share that with someone special, you do. But a journal is a private matter, and these stories, in a way, represent that. So that's part of my hope. And the other part you mentioned, I love to speak. I love to educate. I'm a lifelong learner, but I'm also a lifelong teacher. And I feel I have a decent radio voice, you know, and I always wanted to either speak on the radio, which I'm doing now, and then maybe a future times, I hope. But I would love to speak to an auditorium full of a community center or school. And I'm in the process of investigating how I would go about that. It's been a dream of mine to go to a place where I'm invited, and you know, the honorarium I would get wouldn't be the main thing. Main pleasure would be just the fact that I'm educating and speaking about what matters in life, and I'm sure I would get many questions from the audience, and I'm sure I'd be invited back. And as you can hear, my self-esteem has gone from my shoelaces to well above my head. I'm noticing it's on my clock, 8:24. Is that about when you want it to stop, like with my hope currently?
Well, I think we're heading towards a stopping point. But first of all, I just want to say that as you're telling and speaking this, I have a big smile on my face, and I'm nodding my head. Yes, you have a great radio voice. Yes, I can tell that you're a natural-born teacher, a natural-born, obviously, counselor, unfortunately, for your family at an early age. But you do, like, you know, I think it's somewhat inherent. I'm a teacher as well. I understand that. So you are a teacher. You know, you are, you know, you have this drive to educate, to speak, to share. And I'm just smiling because it's interesting and somewhat almost profound what can come through over the phone line. So thank you for everything that you've shared. I want to share with you that I have a smile on my face and I'm nodding my head. And because I'd like to give you, another minute, one last minute, if you'd like, to leave us with some final thoughts and remarks and words.
Sure.
If you wish.
Well,
okay.
Yeah. Well, briefly, it's very important to feel your own voice. In doing so, you'll feel very inspired, very enthusiastic, very energetic, and always trust your heart. That's what I would leave you with.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you so very much, Simon, for on the show. And I wanted to ask you how, if you want people to connect with you, how can we get in touch with you? Or is there a way to follow you? You said you've written some books. Is there a way to follow you?
Well, let me see. Well, you know, I honestly have used a pseudonym. I the one thing I left out, you know, I'm not, of course, giving my real name. There's a certain anonymity, you know, with sharing these type of things. So that's why I use the pseudonym. But people who called in probably know who I am, and maybe others were able to tell from my story. So I do have a cell number and an email that Pamela has. So if Pamela wants to distribute that, that's fine. I only ask that perhaps someone text the cell number first, because I'm very good at writing and I can think about my answer or whatever. And then if with my permission, we can always speak by phone, I could let them know. And of course, email is very safe, and it's also writing. So Pamela, you can share with those who want my email and my cell number.
Well, thank you. Thank you. So I did send you a friend request. I'm not sure how many Penelope send you friend requests every day, but if you see a Penelope Bennett that sent you a friend request, that would be me. So I did find you on Facebook, and I thank you. And I really just wish to thank you so much for coming on this evening and sharing your story. It takes a lot of courage, and I know it inspired me, and I learned a few things from you this evening. So I want to say thank you.
Well, I wanted to thank you both hosts, and then Pamela, if I may, I wanted to repeat that you said there's either a CD or there's a taping or there's something you could send me. I would like to hear the whole show. Will that be possible for you to get me somehow?
Yes. Yes, I will definitely get you the link of the show.
Oh, wonderful.
So basically when you go on the NASCA website, it's www.nasca.org, and this is for you and for everyone. Right on the front page of the website, you'll see the show schedule, and it'll say the upcoming shows, and you click on that hyperlink, and it'll bring you, it actually has them dated, and you can actually scroll and go back. Click on the hyperlink to the date of your show, your scan number 2686, and it has a brief bio with your name on it, and that's where it will take you right into the archive then. So you can actually just copy that link and send it to anybody that you wish to hear your show. And it's always going to be there in the archives.
That's great. Thank you.
Explanatory. But I know that Pamela will send you the link as well. But just in case, you know, that's how our NASCA family members find the other shows in the archives that they listen to. We do see the numbers of listens, and they do tend to build over time. So they are listen to over a longer period of time. So that's why you're telling your story such a gift that keeps giving to those who need it. So I do,
yes.
I wish to thank you, and I wish to thank my co-host and our producer and our ambassador for Louisiana and one of our NASCA board members, Pamela Elaine Lockridge, for being my co-host this evening. Obviously our very special guest, Simon, And also Mary Jane from Florida, Doug from Maryland, and Kirsten from Texas. And wish to thank you. And I want to remind everyone on behalf of the children, please, if you see something, say something. It is all our job to prevent child abuse. Thank you. Good night, and God bless the children.
Yes, good night, all.
Blog Talk Radio.